1, 2, 2, 1, 2, 2, 1, 2.
Seagulls float between the buildings, borne on the back of the wind. Tower clock strikes in the cold night air, and it's home to Liverpool again.
Welcome to the John Lennon Hour with Jude Sutherland Kessler, author of the John Lennon series. Volume 1, Should Have Been There. Volume 2, Shivering Inside. And Volume 3, She Loves You. Purchase your copy of the John Lennon series at johnlennonseries.com.
Welcome, Beatles fans. This is the John Lennon Hour.
Tower clock strikes in the cold night air, and it's homeward to Liverpool for me. Home to Liverpool again, me boy. Homeward to Liverpool.
The year was 1965, and James Brown had invented funk by stripping everything out except the rhythm and building the foundation for all dance music to follow. In country, Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, Buck Owens, and Merle Haggard rebelled against the Nashville sound. Even Frank Sinatra managed one of his most remarkable comebacks in a career full of them with the Grammy Award-winning albums September of My Years and A Man and His Music. You couldn't turn on the radio without hearing a new classic, like a Rolling Stone. I can't get no satisfaction. Papa's got a brand new bag. My generation. People, get ready. Nowhere Man. Mr. Tambourine Man. The Sound of Silence. Eve of Destruction. Freedom Highway. It's My Life. R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Respect. I Fought the Law. My Girl. Go Where You Want to Go. One Love. A change is going to come. Do you believe in magic? We're going to make it. You've lost that love and feeling in the midnight hour, California dreaming, heart full of soul. I can't help myself. California girls, stop in the name of love. Norwegian Wood, I'll be doggone. I got you, babe. Nowhere to run. Help. Ticket to Ride. And oh yes, Yesterday. The Beatles loomed over 1965 like no other artist has ever done since. From January 65 through January 66, they enjoyed 6 number one U.S. singles in a row, a feat unbroken until the Bee Gees tied it in 1965. A year in which we saw classic television programs like Bonanza and the Andy Griffith Show, the Beverly Hillbillies, Gomer Pyle, Lassie, Big Valley, the Virginian Wild Wild West, the Lucy Show, the Donna Reed Show, and A Man from U.N.C.L.E. You remember that one. In which big screen films were never to be forgotten. Dr. Zhivago, The Sound of Music, the new James Bond flick Thunderball, and a little film that you might remember called Help. The economy was booming, the fight for civil rights was being waged, the pill was being prescribed for married women, and over in a country called Vietnam, a war was raging with American soldiers fighting for their lives. 1965, a landmark year, a year magically brought to you by those powerful words of Andrew Grant Jackson in his new book, The Most Revolutionary Year in Music, 1965, and it was quite a year. This is a great book. If you live through the 60s, it's going to bring back all of the wonderful memories that you hold so close. If you didn't live in the 60s, you're going to be introduced to an epoch that you never dreamed affected your life as much as it does each day. So let's welcome to the show the author of this fantastic book, the one and only Andrew Grant Jackson. Let's see if he's on the line. Andrew, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Jude. Thanks for having me
back.
Love
your book. Well, I love having you here in this book. I mean, I love Still the Greatest about the Beatles solo careers, you know, because you, both you and I love the Beatles. But, man, did this book bring back some good memories for me.
Oh, great. Great. I'm glad. Thank you.
It's really wonderful. Now, one of the things that just grabbed my attention right at the very beginning and held it was the timeline that you give to your readers. You walk them month by month through 1965, and you give them tons of things that happened each month. But I know we don't have time to go over all of those. Could you kind of walk us through that same pathway and give us, like, you know, three or four things that happened each month so we can kind of get a picture of what 1965 looked like?
Sure. Let's see. So starting with January, on the 4th, President Lyndon Johnson announced his plans for the Great Society with programs like Medicare and Medicaid. And then he was inaugurated on the 20th, and it was the biggest inauguration crowd until Obama's, you know, in 2009.
Wow.
And also that month, in just two three-and-a-half-hour sessions, Bob Dylan recorded Bringing It All Back Home, his first album that combined his folk lyrics with rock and roll. And a couple days later, on the 20th, the Byrds recorded their version of his song from that album, Mr. Tambourine Man, where they kind of matched the Beatles' jangle guitar with Dylan's lyrics. And so then in February, at some time in the month, now it's 50 years later, nobody's exactly sure of the date, but John Coltrane released a Love Supreme, which combined you know, bop and free jazz and his spirituality. And and then on the 18th that month was when the civil rights activists in Selma, Alabama, were demonstrating. Jimmie Lee Jackson was fatally shot in the stomach by a state trooper. And so that inaugurated, you know, that started all the protests down there that resulted in, you know, the big march the following month. The 3 or 4 day march, or 4 days, I think. And then on the 21st of February, Malcolm X was assassinated. And then in March, moving into March, on the 8th, the first combat troops arrived in Vietnam, 3,500 Marines in China Beach. There were already 23,000 advisors there, American advisors. But
been there since Eisenhower, right? They've been there since the end of the Eisenhower administration. So, but this is the first time we're seeing troops really go over, right?
Yeah, they also that month, Johnson started the Rolling Thunder bombing campaign. And so these troops that landed were originally protecting, like, the air bases and stuff over there. And later that month, on the 24th, they had the first teach-in at the University of Michigan, which was inspired by the sit-ins of the civil rights movement. But in this case, it was protesting the war. Then on the 25th of that month of March was when Martin Luther King gave his How Long, Not Long speech at the Alabama State Capitol after the marchers had marched for 4 days from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama.
Wow.
And that was what ultimately resulted in the Voting Rights Act later that year, where before that, you know, they would use all these tactics to dissuade black voters from voting. But one of the things the Voting Rights Act did was send monitors down, federal monitors down to the South to make sure they weren't doing anything fishy like that anymore, and then really changed the voting demographics of that area.
Yeah. Right.
And in April, Mr. Tambourine Man by the Byrds was released, and the Byrds were really taken off in Los Angeles on the Sunset Strip and at the club where they played, Ciro's Nightclub. That was, a lot of people say that was where the first hippie dance style started happening, because dance troupe. Yeah, they followed them around, and they did all that kind of free-form dancing with, instead of the twist, you know, it's like a new form of moving around, listening to music.
I love it, and that brought us from straight from that club to the hippies, and then straight to our friends Michelle and Joni Lapidus, who carry it on today.
Yeah, at the Fest for Beatles.
On the stage at the Beatles Fest. I love it. That's when it all started right there. Very cool.
And also that year, The Pawnbroker was released, and that was the first movie approved by the U.S. Production Code where they showed frontal female nudity for the first time. It finally, you know, yeah. It had been censored up till then, but that was the first time. And in May, the British invasion of the U.S. charts, it was the high point where they had 8 of the top 10 singles in the U.S. charts were English songs. And one of them was Australian. So that was at the most that the British artists kind of took over the charts in those, you know, 64 and 65 was the first wave of the British invasion.
Yeah.
And, then there was another huge teach-in in Berkeley, California. That one had like 10 to 30,000 people. Jerry Rubin was one of the organizers of that. And in Jamaica, Bob Marley and the Wailers were releasing songs like Rude Boy and also a ton of Beatles covers, funnily enough. They covered like Ringo's theme, like the instrumental from A Hard Day's Night. They were just doing all this crazy stuff over there.
That's great.
June, on the 7th, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in Griswold versus Connecticut that states could not outlaw the birth control pill because some of the states like Connecticut had been outlawing contraception, but the Supreme Court said no, and that kind of paved the way for Johnson using the pill and programs with the Great Society, like in his war on poverty, and it really after that the number of women on the pill escalated a lot.
Yeah.
And James Brown released Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, which was the tune, as you said in your introduction, where he began creating the new funk genre by, instead of concentrating on melody, making all the instruments serve as a form of drumming. And I Can't Get No Satisfaction also came out then. Maybe the anthem of the decade. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, we're Beatles people, but that one's pretty close too.
Was it played every 6 seconds on the radio somewhere? Isn't that the statistic, every 6 seconds?
Oh, wow. Yeah,
amazing.
That year or throughout the decade?
No, it still is today. Somewhere in the world today, that song is played still every 6 seconds on the radio.
Wow.
Yeah. Pretty Great. Impactful.
And let's see, in July, that year or that month, Dylan released Like a Rolling Stone, and then he got booed on the 25th at the Newport Folk Festival for going electric. All the folkies, or a vocal portion of them, thought he was selling out, you know?
Yeah.
And on the 28th, Johnson doubled the draft. The men drafted to Vietnam per month went up from 17,000 to 35,000. And then 2 days later, as part of the Great Society and War on Poverty, he signed into law Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, public television, public radio, food stamps, Housing and Urban Development Department, National Endowment of the Arts. So he was...
That's huge, isn't it? I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, he was in all directions. He was busy that month for sure. And then
I would
in August,
being a little kid, I don't remember any of this stuff because, you know, I was little, but that's earth-changing. I mean, that changed the face of the United States, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I have an aunt who needs, you know, assistance. She's, and without the Medicare helping, you know, and Medicaid, you know, she'd be,
right.
It'd be a lot harder for everybody, so.
Yeah, it really is. And that brings us, what, to August? We're up to August?
Yeah, and on the 6th, Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, you know, which we spoke a little bit about, with Martin Luther King Jr. was there at the Capitol. And the day before that, actually, on the 5th, CBS News with Walter Cronkite, it showed American soldiers burning Vietnamese villagers' huts. And Johnson was furious and called the network president in the middle of the night. And that might have been the first time that the networks kind of stopped going with the program, I guess, and started showing some of the things in the wars that they didn't, that the government didn't want them to show, you know.
Right.
And on the 9th, MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, started a new CTSS file system with the earliest form of email. It was called mail. So that was who knew what that was going to blossom into, you know, 50 years later.
No joke.
On the 15th, the Beatles played Shea Stadium, the first concert in a sports stadium.
Yeah.
And that eventually changed, you know, turned into stadium rock and arena rock and all that stuff. And so then in September, Mary Quant, am I moving fast enough for you, or should I?
Oh, yeah, this is great. I love it. It's mind-boggling that this all happened in 1 year.
Yeah, it was definitely fun to write about because there's so much, every month, so much stuff going on.
It is. So I guess Mary Quant's bringing in swinging London with her fashion, huh?
Yeah, she went on a tour, an eight-city tour called Youthquake, the Youthquake tour of U.S. department stores. And the models were, you know, modeling mini skirts, and they had this band called the Skunks with these guys with white stripes and their black hair, and they played Youthquake, this song Youthquake, which I think you can hear on YouTube. I think I heard it on YouTube when I was writing it.
So cool.
And, you know, a month later, Jean Shrimpton really caught a lot of flack, the supermodel Jean Shrimpton, because she went to the Victoria Derby in Australia wearing what was, in effect, a miniskirt, although by today's standards, it's still pretty close to her knee, you know. But
everybody
in Australia was outraged. Or not everybody, but a lot of people were.
Yeah.
A lot of women were criticizing her. And Eve of Destruction hit number one that month, and Barry McGuire's song, and that, you never know, but, you know, one of the first lines in that song is, "You're old enough to kill, but not for voting." That might have been an instrumental part of finally, a couple of years later, they were able to lower the voting age from 21 to 18. And maybe that song playing every day kind of helped change people's minds a little bit about that issue.
And one of the things you point out in your book is that starting with Eve of Destruction and now going from we're in September going to the end of the year, that things begin to get dark, that you all of your happy beboppy songs have been the first of the year, and now end of 65, even the Beatles are going to release, you know, darker songs like Yesterday, which is, you know, regretful. So the music kind of changes at this point, doesn't it?
Yeah, a perfect example of that is another song that Sound of Silence kind of it had been an acoustic track a year ago that had on an album by Simon Garfunkel that had kind of flopped, but then after the Byrds had a big hit with Mr. Tambourine Man, Dylan's producer, after Dylan finished the session, he had the session musicians record electric backing over the acoustic Sound of Silence and re-released it, and then it became, at the beginning of 66, it was number one. It kind of went up the charts gradually, but that's a really dark song, and that kind of, I think it was probably the war, you know, like I guess, you know, 35,000 kids getting drafted every month kind of changed, like you say, made it a lot darker mood going on.
Sure.
And so moving into October, it's just kind of interesting, dark, too, in a different way. September 15th was when Bill Cosby became the first black man to star in a TV drama with I Spy.
Oh, that's right.
Four Southern stations had decided not to air the show, but eventually, you know, regardless, it became a huge hit.
Yeah.
But so in October, they had, it was another huge round of protests, October 15th, 16th, the Vietnam Day Committee in Berkeley. Well, it was around the world, actually. They had protests in 40 cities across the U.S. and Europe. And in November, on the 19th of November, These Boots Are Made for Walking, Nancy Sinatra recorded it. It didn't get released till the next year, but I'd like to stick that in there. It was kind of before feminism and all that stuff, but the sexual revolution was kind of changing, you know, men and women's relations, and that kind of captured that a little bit.
Definitely.
And, on the 19th, in another Berkeley protest, Allen Ginsberg, the Hells Angels down there had broken up one, or not a broken it up, but attacked a group of protesters earlier. And so Allen Ginsberg had come up with some ideas of how to disarm or to protest in a way that might, you know, fend off attacks from either the Hells Angels or the cops or whoever. And he didn't use the word flower power exactly, but he wrote this essay called Demonstration or Spectacle as Example, as Communication or How to Make a March Spectacle, where he talked about using flowers and playing I Want to Hold Your Hand and doing all this stuff to, kind of change the dynamics going on in these protests. And that kind of led the way to flower power. A couple of years later, they started calling it.
Yeah, yeah.
And November 30th, Ralph Nader published Unsafe at Any Speed.
I think
he's talking about like the Corvair was it had the engine in the back, so people were like crashing on the road. It was spinning out, and he kind of, you know, the big auto industries in Detroit, you know, he kind of forced them to, you know, start addressing safety more. And
I didn't realize it was that early. I mean, that 65 is very early, because he's running on that platform, you know, 20 years later, so that's incredible that's when he released Unsafe at Any Speed.
Yeah, and then they tried to tried to smear him a bit after that, you know, with infidelity, saying he had infidelities, or, you know, trying to impugn his character a lot, did all these things to try to hush him up.
Yeah.
But and then November 27th, Ken Kesey held the first public acid test in Santa Cruz, where they'd spiked the punch bowls with LSD. And the next month, the Grateful Dead started playing as the house band in those things. And as they started expanding into bigger venues, then they started adding light shows, psychedelic light shows, and that became kind of the forerunner of raves and Pink Floyd, crazy light shows, and all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And so in December, let's see, last couple of interesting. Oh, and on the 7th, the Massachusetts Supreme Court upheld high school officials' right to suspend students with long hair. at that point, they still said, "Hey, you, these kids can disrupt class, and that would so administrators can" make them leave school if they have long hair, you know.
Too funny.
And the 16th was when Mary Beth Tinker and Christopher Eckhart wore black armbands to school to protest the war. And they got sent home, and that case went to the Supreme Court eventually in 68, and then they finally won the right to, you know, right to free expression.
Yeah, yeah.
And the last two things were on the 20th, in Alabama, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Civil Rights Organization, announced the formation of the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, and its symbol was the Black Panther.
Right.
And that over in Oakland the following year, you know, Huey Lewis. That wouldn't be
yeah,
right.
No.
Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, they started their own kind of version of the Black Panthers. So there are a couple of different versions going around at the same time for a little bit. And then at the very end of the year, Walter Cronkite's TV show had Andy Warhol got the Velvet Underground on Walter Cronkite, and they were performing some songs. It was a segment about art films. But the Velvet Underground is shown playing their music on there. So
that's crazy. What a year. What a year. And I want to clarify before we move on. We talked a lot about the protests against the Vietnam War and the different things, the armbands and the freedom of expression and the president calling the press in the middle of the night to complain about what was shown on TV. But Andrew and I want to express our appreciation to the Vietnam vets who went over and put their lives at risk for all of us. Many of these young men wanted to go no more than the protesters who were protesting, but they did what they had to do, and it was a terrible, terrible situation, scary in a thousand different ways. And for all of those who served, we appreciate you. And I know that when a lot of these guys came back, they were spat upon and treated badly, and they didn't receive a hero's welcome. So for all of them, our thanks for what you did. Now,
a lot of them, they from their perspective, it was like they thought they had to stop. Like in World War II, nobody stopped Hitler when he was grabbing up all the countries. So they were, from their perspective, they were thinking, you know, the communist menace was taking up all, grabbing more countries, and we had to stop them.
Right.
So it was
right, right.
Different
and
perspectives.
You certainly, yeah, you do what you're told to do. You know, I mean, I had many of my friends' brothers had to go and came back very changed. So, you know, it was a very tough situation. I really love the chapter in which you talk about the factors, the catalysts that led to this gigantic change in culture. One of the things that you say, it's on page 75 and 76 of the book, is that many of the leading British bands, this invasion that you talked about a minute ago, were fronted by art school rockers. And you give examples, John Lennon, Keith Richards, Pete Townsend, Ray Davies, Eric Clapton, and as, you know, kind of the beatniks, the existentialists, free thinkers, activists, they were bringing on this age of enlightenment. What other factors do you think made all of these things happen in one year?
I think the big five things were the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War starting, the pill kind of speeding up the sexual revolution really started getting going. And then, of course, I have a five-year-old daughter, so I'm glad she's not listening, but, you know, marijuana and LSD really started seeping in. I mean, Dylan gave the Beatles their first really good time on it in August 64, and then Brian Wilson started smoking in December 64, the Stones in the beginning of 65, and then the Beatles were dosed without their permission in March of 65 with LSD, and then, yeah, you know, Brian Wilson did it the first time his first month, and then all those guys, the Birds. So psychedelics were definitely, you know, a massive, you know, that really impacted the music. And then I think all those, and then the musicians' long hair too, that kind of made a lot of people start rebelling, or, you know, the kids. So I think all those five elements sort of made a lot of people start demanding or questioning or demanding more personal freedom. And then so the artists started wanting to express that in their lyrics, and then also musically by experimenting with new sounds and things like that. And it just became a giant snowball, like all these social forces, you know, colliding at the same time.
Yeah, our heroes of the late 1950s had been very in the box. If you're thinking about Bobby Vinton and Bobby V and Paul Anka, they're very in the box. And now these heroes are way out of the box. They are these art school rockers. And the people who are leading, especially the Beatles, are very, very outside the lines, aren't they?
Yeah. You know, I recently read a friend of ours, Candy Leonard's book, Beatleness. And a really good point she came back to in that book was that they were providing the Beatles and also the other British invasion guys kind of like a new model of masculinity for both the women and the men, you know, kind of an alternative to the crew cut, you know, strong, silent types, you know, who served in the war and everything, who were really tough, maybe didn't express vulnerability as much and, you know, weren't quite as open to some feminine influences, you know, as these British guys were.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Beatles revere women, sing about them in their songs, are inspired by the Shirelles and the Ronettes and, you know, the Supremes. And John Lennon tells the Supremes how inspired he is by them. So it's a different age. The woman is coming into her own in music, too. Well, you really pointed out the huge variety in music that year. We talked about James Brown. You really had a great chapter about how Nashville had dominated country music, but now they're starting to rebel against Nashville's heavy thumb and become a little bit more pop and rock and roll. The folk sound, you talked about that, the music of the Brill Building Group, these writers who so successfully dominated music for years and years and years. So much variety. What is making people so diverse? And what about George Harrison and what he discovered that year? He becomes very diverse. Tell us that story.
Hey, they were the Beatles were shooting Help, and the plot of that movie, as I'm sure everybody, all your listeners know, is that this kind of a Hindu sect is trying to catch Ringo and kill him because he's got this sacrificial ring on his hand, which is definitely kind of politically incorrect these days, you know, but especially because they had like a white guy playing the Indian guy, something in the
yeah.
But they, you know, in the soundtrack, they had a lot of Indian instrumentation. So one day when they were shooting the scene in a restaurant, an Indian restaurant, George became fascinated with the sitar because his mom, Louise, said she always used to play when he was, even before he was born, but presumably when he was young, they would play Indian music on the BBC or something. And so his mom was a fan of it. And but so he started becoming interested in the sitar and the Yardbirds at the same time, tried to use it in Heart Full of Soul. But they couldn't find a musician who could play in the Western time, you know, keep the same beat that the Westerners did. So Jeff Beck actually used a fuzz box to try to imitate the sitar.
That's crazy.
And then that was kind of the birth of one of the things that birthed psychedelia, trying to imitate Indian music with, you know, Western technology. But and then the Kinks were doing "See My Friend," where Ray Davies was "See My Friend," where he was imitating the sound he heard when he heard these Indian fishermen singing while he was on tour in the East. And so, and then when the Beatles kind of hung out with the Birds in L.A., David Crosby had raved about Ravi Shankar to George.
Yeah.
So he went and bought an album, a couple albums of his, and got a sitar. And so when they were going to record Norwegian Wood, John wanted to add a new flavor to it. So he asked George if he could play the sitar on. George was, I haven't been playing it too long. I'm not sure how great it'll be, but he gave it a go and, you know, started a whole new
phase. And the rest is history.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really did. Well, we have a special guest coming on in about 10 minutes, and I really want to do this segment that we've got. When you were on the show the last time with your first book, Still the Greatest, The Essential Songs of the Beatles Solo Careers, you and I did this rapid-fire 60-second assessment of some of the Beatles solo songs. It was really fun. And I had a hard time selecting the most impactful or important or outstanding songs of 1965 to ask you to give us some back history. There were so, so many, but some of them stood out. And one that I would really love to hear a quick 60-second snippet about, or maybe 90 seconds, is Mr. Tambourine Man. You already mentioned the Birds, but, man, it comes up in the book many times. Tell us about Mr. Tambourine Man.
Well, Dylan wrote it in 64, in April 64, but he didn't, when he tried to record it in his 64 album session, it didn't come out how he liked it. So he re-recorded it in Bringing It All Back Home. And by that time, an acetate of his older version had made it to the Birds manager. And so they also did their own version of it with, you know, the put it to a rock beat with the Django guitar. And so that kind of provided the whole template of the folk rock boom that really exploded that the second half of that year with, you know, Mamas and the Papas, Loving Spoonful, Sonny and Cher, Barry McGuire. It was, so that was a worldwide hit, and not only put kind of helped put Dylan on the map, you know, as a songwriter, and then the Birds, and just so that was a probably, yeah, that might have been one of the most influential songs of the year, definitely.
It was, definitely. I mean, it keeps coming up in the book. I read about it, then 20 pages later, there it is again. People keep re-recording it. What about Nowhere to Run?
That was, you know, Martha and the Vandellas, and it was written, you know, by the Holland Dozier Holland songwriting production team at Motown. And the funny thing with that is, as a Isaac Hayes, who was at Stax, was quoted in the book as saying it was a joke with the black musicians that whites could not clap on the backbeat, so Motown would deliberately try to hit people over the head with it. And so on that song, they had snow chains, you know, like the kind you put on your tires in the winter. And so they beat those along with the beat and the drums and the tambourine. And that song, even though it was about a woman who, you know, can't forget this lover who's bad for her, it became like a, you know, Vietnam veterans would embrace that song, and rioters, you know, or the, you know, the people in the riots in the later part of the year, and then the decade also.
Right.
Definitely
their anthem. And then one that touches your heart has to, A Change Is Gonna Come.
Oh, yeah, that was... That's a really a lot of heavy stuff in that song. Sam Cooke had actually, he had been inspired by Blowing in the Wind, and also by Dylan, of course. And then he had been with some civil rights organizers who had been trying to integrate restaurants in North Carolina, like Howard Johnson's at the time. And so he was writing about that, but then right around that time, unfortunately, his 18-month-year-old son drowned in the family swimming pool. Ugh. And, you know, that really, you know, devastated him. And then his touring party was arrested when they were trying to check into a whites-only motel. And so by the time he sang it, you know, it really had a total devastation in the lyrics, but it still... he's still carrying on at the end, you know. And then, of course, he died. You know, he was killed on December 11th. And so it had been an album track, but the label released it, and eventually it made number 31 on the pop charts in February of 65.
I'm surprised it didn't go higher than that. It's such a beautiful song. What about You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling?
Oh, yeah, that was Phil Spector. He had been previously with the girl groups primarily, but after the British invasion, his songs like the Ronettes, Walking in the Rain, suddenly he wasn't cracking the top 20, so he switched to a male group, you know, the Righteous Brothers, and that's where he got the Brill. He flew the he was out in LA, I guess, and so he got the songwriting team Man and Wheel from the Brill Building to fly out. And they were inspired by the Four Tops, Baby, I Need Your Lovin'. And so he did, you know, obviously a monumental job producing it. But then it was 3 minutes and 45 seconds. And that was longer than radio stations would play at that time. So he just said, well, we'll just say it's 3 minutes and 5 seconds on the label. And, you know, he just printed the label, like, you know, lied on the label. And by the time they figured it out, it was too late. It was a huge number one smash.
I love that. I love Chuck Gunderson's explanation that when the Righteous Brothers had to open for the Beatles on the North American tour, and of course nobody would listen to them sing, that finally they lost that loving feeling and quit the tour. So, yeah, I always think about that when I hear that song. And then for our boys, Help.
Help was, I always thought it was really interesting that a year prior to that, the Beatles were shooting A Hard Day's Night, and John had written that song in one night. He went home and he just wrote A Hard Day's Night one night.
Yep.
And then he did the same thing with Help. Oh, I'm just going to write Help in one night. And he, at the time, his friend journalist Maureen Cleave had, you know, said, yeah, you never use words with more than one syllable in it. And Lennon was feeling kind of competitive with Bob Dylan at that time. So he added all these, you know, longer words like insecure, independent, self-assured, appreciate in the lyrics. And then it was sort of a precursor to his later, like, Plastic Ono Band kind of raw emotional honesty, which is pretty surprising left turn in retrospect. You know, you have like 8 days a week, 1 month, and then suddenly he's singing Help, you know, like, which is pretty emotionally raw song. So it really showed their depth, I think.
It's one of my favorites. I'm going to be this Saturday night in the middle of the night, I think it's like 4 a.m., on Rod Quinn's overnight program in Australia, and this is one of the songs that we talk about for about 15 minutes. It's a landmark song, and we're going to talk about the Dylan myth that John never wrote biographical songs until Dylan came along. Now, one of the songs that you talk about quite a bit, because a lot of people did it, even the Beatles, is Memphis. But tell us about that from the Buck Owens perspective.
Well, he and the Beatles were both on Capitol, you know, the Capitol Records label. And Owens would play Twist and Shout in his set, and he and his guitarist, Don Rich, they would sometimes, you know, do Liverpool accents and stuff, and wear Beatles wigs. And, you know, they, especially after the Beatles arrived in America, you could hear on Beatles for Sale, you know, definitely, I think you can, and even before, like Without Crying said, you can hear like a country influence, but I Don't Want to Spoil the Party, I'm a Loser. They were definitely, you know, especially Ringo was, you know, always wanting Buck Owens records. So there was they were both listening to each other, but Buck Owens would get criticized for saying he liked the Beatles, because the country fans would say, you should be talking about country music. It was kind of like the same thing in the folk world with Dylan. You know, the sides thought they were selling out if you were diverse in your tastes, but. He covered Chuck Berry's Memphis, Tennessee on his album I've Got a Tiger by the Tail. And then he got a lot of attacks. And so he put out an ad in the Music City News in Nashville, a Nashville paper, and he said, I shall sing no song that is not a country song. I shall make no record that's not a country record. Country music and country music fans made me what I am today, and I shall not forget it. But later he kind of said to an interviewer, you know, I see Memphis as being rockabilly. I didn't say I was going to do rockabilly. I just said I ain't going to sing no song that ain't a country song. but I mean, if Memphis's lyrics aren't country lyrics, if the melody, if that ain't a country melody, you know, and he said the only thing was a black man was singing it, a black man that I was a big fan of.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. Sure. And then one that we really cherish and was one of the best songs of the year, Ticket to Ride.
Oh, yeah, that was – I always thought – I kind of think – I don't know, what do you think about this? You know the ending, the fade-out of A Hard Day's Night? They have that
– Yeah.
To me, it always sounded like – they were like, wow, that was a great fade-out. And we kind of like – we didn't take full advantage of that amazing sound. And so it almost sounds like they took that and made that – the kind of beginning of Ticket to Ride, and not exactly.
Yeah, but, like, you could play them together, fade one out and fade one in.
Yeah, that was just, that and the Birds, that's jangle pop right there, you know, which, you know, has continued on with R.E.M. and all the groups later on, you know, in the 80s until today. But Paul had the, that's like a great example of, even though John wrote the lyrics, Paul kind of had the idea for the drum beat, and then he showed it to Ringo, and then I guess Paul played the electric guitar, the lead guitar on that one. And that was like, I think that was the first, do you agree with this? It was like their first single. I mean, they had sad album songs before, but this was kind of the first time their single had been kind of a downbeat song. Like, I mean, it's one of my favorite songs, but it's kind of the first time he started, I'm going to be sad, you know, singing about being sad and stuff instead of happy. So that was kind of brave.
Right.
You know?
You've had it before on songs like I'll Cry Instead and If I Fell and things like that, but now you have it in a single, too. They're being very, very honest. I know we're going to get, our caller's going to call in any minute, so let's skip to Yesterday. Tell us about Yesterday.
Well, that was, you know, Paul was living when he wasn't on tour in Jane Asher's family's house in London, and his mom, well, she taught classical music. I think she was George Martin's oboe instructor, I think. And Paul had used a music room in there to write stuff, and then one morning he woke up with a dream of a melody that so he ran to the piano and played it, and for a year he thought maybe he had subconsciously plagiarized it, so he would play it for everybody to say, hey, do you know this song? Do you recognize this song? And but nobody did, but he couldn't come up with good lyrics for it. But finally, after a year of tinkering with it, he, you know, the words to Yesterday came to him, and later on he thought maybe it was subconsciously inspired by the loss of his mother to an extent.
Yeah.
But it was amazing. He recorded, in retrospect, he must have been bummed out, Paul, because I think his songs in the movie Help were not his ultra classics, but then after it was too late to add songs to the movie, but for the album, he recorded in one day, Yesterday, I've Just Seen a Face and I'm Down, like in one session, boom, boom, boom. And,
right, the Parlophone, the Parlophone.
Pardon me?
The Parlophone LP, not the Capitol release. It's on that side, too, of the Parlophone release for our listeners who, you know, we take it for granted that they know what we're talking about. But, yeah, on side two of the Parlophone release, they're there. Well, Andrew, you know, we can't talk about 1965 without talking about the Beatles. And like we were just saying, it's their LP and their movie Help. And John writes his second book, A Spaniard in the Works. And, of course, the second North American tour. But one can't look at 1965 without looking at the gigantic influence of Berry Gordy's Motown. The Beatles totally felt it. I mean, they imitated and borrowed from the Temptations, whom they loved, and Marvin Gaye, and the Shirelles, and the Supremes, and all of them. And in a very strange way, David Ruffin of the Temptations was sort of a John Lennon figure and vice versa. John was a David Ruffin figure. You point out in your book that, you know, they both have those thick black frame glasses that made them cutting edge cool. Ruffin's kind of the hothead. He's like John, the more egotistical one in the Temptations. In fact, at one point, he wants it to be David Ruffin in the Temptations. And just so happened that when I was traveling to the New York Metro Fest for Beatles fans, I happened to sit on the airplane between two of the nicest guys I ever met. One was a guy named Kenny Santana, who was the manager for the young man sitting on my left, who just happened to be David Ruffin's grandson, Marquise. And he is a talented singer in his own right. So I invited him to join us to talk about the Temptations and to talk about his career, too. Let's see if he's on the line. Marquise, are you there?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Hey, can you hear us?
Yeah, I hear you.
Great. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad. Yourself?
Well, good. I want to introduce you to Andrew Grant Jackson, who's just written this book on 1965, and we're dying to hear what memories. I know you were probably born, you know, long after your grandfather was in the Temptations, but what family stories and memories do you have of him?
To be honest, it's all from other people's mouths, because he had passed away when I had turned one, so I don't really have too many memories. But from what I know, he was such a pioneer in the music industry, and I could see it with him, like, for myself, doing my own business as far as the music goes as well, and how much of an influence he was on other people and other artists and whatnot. So, yeah, as far as memories go, that's say, she say for me.
Right, right. You were too young. And, Andrew, you had a question for him too, didn't you?
Yeah, I was curious for the when you perform, or just for your own listening, everybody knows, like, the Temptation hits, like you know, My Girl, I Wish It Would Rain, that your grandfather sang on. But are there any deeper cuts or album cuts or songs that he did that should have been hits when he was solo but didn't quite, you know, become huge, that you personally love, that you would recommend we check out, like people who want to get a deeper appreciation of them?
Yeah, for sure. You have Statue of a Man, Walk Away from Love. Those are some of his biggest hit. Well, not his biggest, but some records people can refer to as far as his solo career goes. And I guess what makes it kind of hard is because everyone knows him for being David Ruffin of the Temptations versus being David Ruffin, the solo artist. So maybe the impact of him being solo wasn't so big because he had none of the antics to follow, like, for what he's known for.
Right.
But those are definitely records that speak to people. It's almost like myself, kind of like how I try to be. They're genuine. It's music. It's relatable by many.
Well, tell us about your music and the sort of music that you're performing right now and how people can get your music, Marquise.
Okay. For me, I've come a long way from when I first started. I started singing around 17, 18, so I was a late bloomer. But the type of music I do now is, I would consider it to be, by way of genre, for the familiar ear, it's R&B. But on a deeper level, it's alternative R&B for me. And I say that because it's alternative to what you're used to hearing as R&B. And I there's still substance. There's mass in my music. It's not so radio, but I still give you the beat behind it that allows you to make you feel like you're still listening to the radio. But as you listen, and only when you listen, you can relate to what I'm saying on a more genuine level, outside of just like, oh, I want to hear this song because it's cool. So.
And so you write your own? Do you write your own songs?
Yeah, I write. Everything that you hear from me is written by me. And if it's not written by me, then it's written by my uncle, who's also like a huge influence on everything that I do. But you can hear the difference now when I write and when he writes. So, yeah, it's all me.
And so if people want to hear your music, where do they go?
You can find me on SoundCloud, first name Marquise. MARQUISE, last name Ruffin. You can find me there. You can find me on Twitter, YouTube, same thing. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Those are the main ways of getting in touch with me. So,
well, that is great, and we appreciate so much that you've taken that inspiration from this revolutionary year in music, 1965, and you, as they say on American Idol, until we're ready to jump off a bridge, you've made it your own, but you have, and your music is beautiful, and we're going to close the show in a few minutes with your song Can't Be Friends, which is gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous.
Oh,
and
I appreciate it.
Well, we will be talking to you again. I want to have you back on the show again. But thank you for calling in today, and good luck to you. And I'm going to keep the audience posted on where you go from here. We're going to be watching your career.
Well, thank you for having me. I thank you for the questions and whatnot. I appreciate the love. I look forward to being on again.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon, Marquise. Thank you for calling.
You as well.
Well, was that exciting or what, to have the grandson of David Ruffin on the show?
I wonder if, when he said his uncle, I wonder if that uncle is the son of Jimmy Ruffin, the other, the brother of David Ruffin, who was a Motown guy, you know, as well.
I bet it was. Sweet, sweet guys. I really enjoyed meeting them. You know, we could totally do another show, and let's think about doing that, like in July on this book, because we didn't get to talk about Bob Dylan's love affair with the Beatles. He loves them in the beginning of 65, then he's mad at them and doesn't like them, calls them bubblegum, then he falls for them again. We didn't get to talk about the Stones, and there's just so many things. But I want to tell our listeners that this book is written in such a beautiful way. It doesn't give you topics like the Stones, Dylan, or whatever. It unfolds month by month, as you did at the first of the show, through winter and then into spring and then into summer, and 1965 unfolds for you, and it is a great ride. So, Andrew, where can people get a copy of the book?
They can get it in a lot of, Barnes & Nobles, or at least I'm in California, the local booksellers have it, but you can always get it on Amazon as well if the physical bookstores aren't selling it, then you can order it on Amazon.
And you and I had a great time at the Fest for Beatles Fans in Los Angeles. Any plans that you'll be at the Chicago Fest?
Yeah, I definitely want to go because I know Al Sussman, another writer, another Beatle writer, he's been doing his own 65 series on his Facebook page, and so we can all have a 65 discussion out in Chicago. It'd be great.
Yes. And I told Al I definitely want him to come on the show in June. Why don't the three of us plan to do a show together? Because we can really rock 1965.
Terrific. Yeah, whenever you want to do it, I'm here. That'd be great.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight. And we have about 3 minutes left, so we're going to close out with Marquise Ruffin's song, Can't Be Friends. Listen, enjoy it. Ta-ra. And shine on.
Oh, oh. Tell me how I'm supposed to feel when you say you don't want this no more. I'm